Welcome to Parents Perspective. Don't touch anything. Lydia looked at both of her children sternly. It's very important. Mom, 12-year-old Jasmine rolled her eyes. It's not like it's the plague or anything. Chill out. Young lady, Lydia retorted, we are in a crowded airport. Hey, Mom, 10-year-old Josh interrupted. Does this mean I don't have to carry this dumb bag? He looked up hopefully. Good try, smarty pants, Lydia grimaced. She took a deep breath. You both know about this epidemic. Your school was nearly closed, so you know that a lot of people are getting very sick. Yeah, but, began Jasmine. No buts, Lydia countered. Any surface you have to touch, like these security bins for your shoes and jackets, you use your hand sanitizers afterwards. That is it. She tossed her own bin onto the conveyor belt. We can't bring germs to your cousins, and certainly not to Aunt Sherry. Her baby is due next month. Hey, Josh perked up. I heard this story about a guy who cleaned his hands so much that his skin just fell off. From a parent's perspective, what should we know about travel with children in a time of high contagion? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest works with infectious diseases in children. Dr. Eric Stern currently serves as Assistant Professor of Pediatrics in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Georgetown University Hospital. His primary duties include working with clinical inpatient pediatric infectious disease and teaching of medical students and residents. Welcome to Parents Perspective, Dr. Stern.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you, Sandy, for having me here today.
Dr. Stern, what's the biggest error we lay people make about being out and about in times of viral epidemics?
I think both that question as well as getting back a second to Sandy's introductory story are great jumping-off points to just discuss what it's like traveling with children. We'll make it 18 and under, just for the sake of discussion. But the story that we let off with, there are a few sort of buzzwords in there I'd like to get back to. The crowded airport, if you all remember, the use of the word this epidemic or the plague, it's not the plague, Mom. And then the reference to pregnant women at home potentially being at high risk. And I'm sure in this day and age, everyone out there is aware that there is an epidemic of influenza that is not just in the United States and in the Western world, but is worldwide. It is true. There is a lot of fear, some well-founded and some perhaps less well-founded than we spend a lot of time as infectious disease doctors, and certainly you guys, parents, trying to reassure people that some of the fear doesn't necessarily need to be there. So traveling with children in general, the reason this topic probably appears is because it's so important for a kid to travel with their families. And I think for a child's development and for a child's sort of sense of wonder to be expanded, having kids leave their sort of friendly confines with their families is very important if you can do it. And there are some things that I think we should talk about to be on alert for. But for the most part, I think my take-home message for parents is that it is safe to travel with children. And mostly the things that you should worry about when you leave your block are the same things that you should worry about when you're at home and when you're in the friendly confines. So the crowded airport, in general, you hear with the influenza nowadays, try to avoid crowded spaces if possible. Things like, you know, movie theaters and buses and metros, supermarkets, airports no different. And we can't all avoid all those places. That basically sums up 90% of the world. You should try to have the same type of behaviors taking place when you leave home and you're traveling as when you're home.
Which are?
Well, you know, you think about how you live your life on a day-to-day basis, and then you take your children, you decide to go on a big trip, be it to Florida to visit grandparents or to Tanzania to visit a game park. And I think what has been well described in various different places in the scientific literature, as well as in developmental literature, is that folks tend to be more adventurous when they travel.
A lot of people are going to be traveling to visit family during certain seasons. What kinds of things should parents pay attention to in keeping in mind that we've got a flu epidemic going on?
So the flu epidemic, no matter what we do today, we're going to end up talking about flu. So let's talk about flu. The flu is a virus that circulates year-round. In the United States and in Western parts of the world, for the most part, we have a stable flu season that starts sometime in the fall, November, December, and usually tails off in the spring and is all but gone by the time school is out in May and June. Our circulating influenza, there's types A and B. Type A influenza is more severe than type B influenza, and we get information on which strains of circulating A and B flu will exist in the West based on the circulating strains in the Southern Hemisphere 6 months prior. And the WHO in Geneva, as well as the influenza branch out of the CDC in Atlanta, look at the surveillance data from the circulating strains of flu in the Southern Hemisphere in order to select this three strains. There's only three strains, 2A and 1B, that go into our yearly flu vaccine. And it's a bit of a gamble. So you hope that you have a nice match in your flu vaccine and that what actually was causing flu in India and Thailand and Indonesia, by the time November, December, January rolls around in D.C., New York, L.A., that you have a perfectly matched flu vaccine. Some years they nail it, and some years they don't. So that's general influenza. And what is happening now with this swine flu? So the swine flu pandemic, being that there's an epidemic, there's an outbreak of swine flu that's taking place at various locations at the same time around the world. It's a pandemic. The swine flu pandemic, it's also a flu A, but it is a flu A that we previously had no evidence of immunity to and that didn't match any of the circulating flu A strains last year. So I was working in infectious disease in San Diego at Children's Hospital in San Diego when the first two cases of this new swine flu were identified by an organization called BIDS, the Border Health Infectious Disease Surveillance Group. And they were identified as, we have two children with recent travel from Mexico who have influenza-like symptoms. Their rapid tests were negative. They sent samples to the CDC for typing, and the samples didn't match any of the known circulating strains of flu A. So initially, swine flu in April and May of 2009 was called influenza A non-typable. And finally, you know, with more cases and as the epidemic spread, it got a name, and ultimately it was grown up and a vaccine was created just to this swine flu. The swine flu that we have circulating now is not particularly different from influenza. It is a flu virus. It behaves like a flu virus. It's not known to be more virulent than the normal influenza A virus or viruses that can circulate on a yearly basis. The main differences are two. Number one, younger folks don't have any evidence of immunity to this circulating swine flu. There was a antigenically similar virus that circulated decades ago that might explain why those 60 and above have sort of less severe symptoms and may have some underlying immunity. Some say up to a third of folks 60 and above probably have some level of immunity to this swine flu. So that's the first major difference is for many of us, young folks, infants, 18 and under, pregnant women, this is a novel flu virus for us. And then the second main difference I alluded to earlier is the epidemiology. This virus isn't really behaving like a normal flu virus. It's not going away in May and June and coming back in December. This virus, at least for the last 8 months, has been here to stay, and we had cases right through the summer. July, August, and our flu season started tremendously early, as you all know. In September and October, we've seen flu, and it's all swine flu. Although we're recommending, CDC's recommending getting a seasonal flu vaccine because there is some circulating regular flu A and B, it is extremely minimal what is out there that is not swine flu.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on traveling with children during a time of high contagion.
popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Eric Stern about traveling with children during a time of high contagion.
Do people who get sick with flu in this period of time that's not your typical flu seasonal time all have to be tested to see if it's swine flu, or they're just treated and assume that that's what it is?
Actually, those on the front lines really seeing the bulk of influenza-like illness or confirmed flu are emergency room doctors and clinic doctors. The great majority of patients who get influenza normally or swine flu this year do fine, stay home, don't require any treatment. And from an infectious disease standpoint, we see the tip of the iceberg. We see just the very rare patients who get very, very sick, usually with a complicated bacterial pneumonia after their swine flu. But the answer to the testing question, there's a lot of I don't knows here, Linda, so I'm going to give you some I don't knows. Okay. But what I'll tell you what we do when you have a patient during this pandemic time who has a clinical illness that could be consistent with influenza, so someone, you know, short incubation period, who's maybe been sick for only a few days, 1, 2, 3 days with influenza, when you're exposed, if you're going to get flu, usually you'll get it within 7 to 10 days. So someone who perhaps had a contact, either known or unknown contact, to someone who was sick with a flu-like illness, who comes in just feeling rotten, with fever, with headache, with chills, with muscle aches, with sore throat, maybe with runny nose, maybe with cough, that person in the right setting, if they're a pregnant person or if they're a child, certainly a child under the age of 4, persons that we know are at higher risk of doing poorly with swine flu, you might decide to test them in your clinic or emergency room or on the hospital floor. And the first test we usually do is the rapid flu test, which looks for proteins. It's an antigen test. It looks for A and B. There are tests that will just say positive, it's A or B, and then there are tests that will say yes, it's A, or yes, it's B. And this test, it's like flipping a coin right now for swine flu. It's not a great test. It's a 50-50 chance for the most part that if you have true full-blown swine flu, the test will come back positive saying you have flu A. So if it's positive, it's helpful for us. If it's negative, it's not that helpful. And there are a confirmatory test because we don't want to overwhelm our local and state health departments, but in certain settings, we'll ask them to do what's called a PCR test, which tries to look for little snippets of swine flu DNA floating around. And that's done on just a nasal swab, a Q-tip swab in the nose, or a nasal washing, which gets more cells. And those tests usually take a few days for the results to come back. Regarding treatment, the answer is it depends. And there are certainly groups that we immediately treat, whether we know they actually have a positive test or not, to avoid complications. And those are a couple that I alluded to, pregnant women who we know are at increased risk of doing poorly with swine flu, children less than 4, and those with certain immunocompromising conditions, patients with cancer or chemotherapy, et cetera.
If we're traveling with children, say we're flying someplace either in the United States or abroad, are there certain conditions that we need to be alert for?
So in general, air travel is safe. Influenza is a respiratory pathogen, as we all know, and it's transmitted by large droplets. So we're all sitting at a table, and we're roughly 3 feet apart from each other, face to face. If any of us were sick and were actively coughing large droplets, which can remain viable for hours on hands, on doorknobs, and then if there's contact and then either ingestion or if your fingers are put into your eyes, it's possible to get the flu that way.
So in terms of you're taking a child on an airplane or a train or something, and you're worried about flu, is there anything you should be doing, you shouldn't be doing?
My concerns would be different if you were taking, a 6-week-old on a long international trip who hadn't been vaccinated at all for swine flu versus a 15-year-old.
How about the 9-year-old who wants to touch everything?
A 9-year-old who wants to touch everything. That's a good age. I remember that age. In general, you know, while the recommendations from both local health departments as well as the CDC are to vaccinate everyone for both seasonal flu as well as this season, at least we know for swine flu, and that includes those 9 and under. So the 9-year-old's right on the cusp, but 9 and under in their first season of getting vaccinated should be getting 2 shots. With the exception of vaccinating and assuring vaccination if you can, any child, the 9-year-old included, there are no special precautions at all that I would really worry about for traveling with the kid in this time of flu season. Yes, there is.
No hand sanitizers.
So in general, the normal practices we try to sort of drum into our children are to wash their hands if they sneeze or to wash their hands after coming back from the bathroom. Wash their hands if they've been soiled or they've been playing outside. These are the same exact recommendations we would make for a 9-year-old on a trip to Europe. I might pack a little bottle of Purell just in case there was a long line from the bathroom. But with the exception of normal hand hygiene, covering your mouth when you cough, and potentially trying to avoid someone who's actively coughing around you, I think I would just emphasize that we're at risk of getting influenza or any, you know, winter respiratory cough and cold illness anywhere we go, whether it's an airport, an airplane, another country, or just the supermarket down the street.
It's not more problematic if you're all together in a sealed up airplane than if you're at a shopping mall?
Well, again, if we recall the mode of transmission, it's so face-to-face, prolonged contact, and large droplets. So yes, if you know your 9-year-old child Jimmy is sitting in 9C and directly across the aisle and 9A is a 45-year-old guy who used a whole pack of Kleenex already and the flight's only 40 minutes long and he's coughed and sneezed and he's looks like he's sweating, you know, that might be the instance in which you would alert the hostess, is it possible that this person has an infectious disease? But that's a special circumstance where you can actually tell that someone's ill. With many illnesses, there's something called an incubation period where you're exposed to the pathogen and then there's a period in which the pathogen is replicating and you're not sick. And then there's something called a prodromal period where you just feel crummy but you don't have the classic symptoms. And in influenza, we know for 24 hours before you actually get your fever, runny nose, cough, sore throat, et cetera, you can be infectious. So that's probably not reassuring to people out there.
No.
But
everyone in line next to you is going to say, how are you feeling today?
Exactly. So with that in mind, we can't avoid everyone on the earth. That's several billion people. And we're not going to stop traveling and we're not going to stop exploring. So with the exception of actively trying to avoid contact with the respiratory droplets of likely infectious people who look really sick, I think we need to just go about living.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on traveling with children during a time of high contagion.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Eric Stern about traveling with children during a time of high contagion. What if we're traveling where a pediatrician isn't likely to be available? Are there certain things we should watch for if a child becomes sick, certain red flags?
Yeah, there are. Another take-home message. In general, when we travel and leave the United States, we need to remember that vaccine-preventable diseases that are very rare in the U.S., like varicella and measles and mumps, may not be so rare where we're traveling to. So the number one recommendation for any kid 18 and under is to have his shots up to date. And this has been reinforced in the last couple of years by there was a mumps epidemic, as you all know, a mumps outbreak in the Midwest and Indiana. There was a measles outbreak in San Diego that was precipitated by an unvaccinated 9-year-old who had traveled with his family to Switzerland, where there's a higher rate of measles. Came back, he was in a school with higher percentage of vaccine refusers than the normal population. And long story short, we ended up with around, I think it was 11 cases of measles just from this one traveler. So where you're going, if there's no pediatrician, make sure that your child is up to date on his regular vaccines. And then things to look out for. The most common thing to happen to a child when they travel is the same thing that happens to an adult, which is a little bit of diarrhea. And a little bit of diarrhea is not a main concern. Now, a lot of diarrhea with a punky-looking child who's dehydrated or listless, that is a concern. And maintaining hydration of your child, both with, you know, Gatorade or oral rehydration solutions, is essential when they're losing water. And if you can't maintain their hydration, that's where I would get worried. And then this sort of segues, if there's not a pediatrician, what should I bring with me? You know, bringing a medical kit on any travel is a good idea, and having things in your medical kit like bandages and topical antibiotics and topical antifungals is pretty standard.
Topical meaning goes on the surface,
goes on the
not
skin.
Internally.
You know, if a child gets a little rash or is allergic to something when he travels or is bitten by a bug and then it gets super infected, you might put some antibiotic lotion on there. Traveling with antibiotics, adults travel who travel for a living or travel, to distant lands, often take the antibiotics Cipro and Flagyl with them in the event of traveler's diarrhea. With children, I think as a parent and as a pediatrician, I would want someone to see my child if their diarrhea doesn't go away. And most diarrhea, either caused from a virus or E. coli, will go away in a couple of days. And in the setting of the punky child who has either diarrhea that doesn't go away or diarrhea with now blood in it, those would be concerns for me that would make me not want to give the child antibiotics but would want someone to see that child.
I want to tell just a quickie little story because it might be helpful for families who are traveling with children. I discovered that libraries have books that are wonderful for preparing a child for what could happen if that child gets sick. I have an almost 3-year-old grandson, and he has a library book out right now called Iris Has a Virus. And I had a wonderful time reading him this book because Iris also has a twin brother who's fine. And Iris notices in her classroom a lot of her favorite friends are missing from school. They're absent. Mm-hmm. And the teacher says there's a nasty virus out there. And then the teacher uses the term about a bug. It's a bug. And so Iris has a dream about all kinds of bugs crawling and flying and eating different things and dressed in different clothes and riding in cars. And she throws up in a pot. And there's a picture of a little girl with her head in a big bucket. And in a few days, she's fine. And her twin brother gets sick. And all I could think of was my grandson is going to have this in his head that if he doesn't feel well, number one, he'll make it known. Number two, he's going to know that you do get well, but other people might get sick if you are sick, or if someone else is sick, you might catch it.
That's a great story. That's commonly the way travel infections are with children. They're viruses. They give them some loose poops, and in a couple of days, things run their course. We mentioned incubation periods earlier. As a travel medicine doctor who is seeing a patient who's traveled, who is now recently returned, there are some classic incubation periods you would want to know about. And there are short and long, and most things run their course. But if you're going to a tropical area with a high mosquito burden, DEET, and then certainly working with a travel clinic prior to going.
Well, clearly this is a discussion that could go on a very long time further than we're doing. But before we close, what resources would you suggest, Dr. Stern, to listeners who want to pursue further some of these issues we've been discussing?
There's a lot of great resources out there, and we're happy from an infectious disease standpoint to answer questions and see patients if they're about to travel, if they're coming back from travel. I'll just sort of point out a few highlight resources. www.cdc.gov, there's a Traveler's Health section, otherwise known as the Yellow Book for Traveler's Health. which you can search country by country, disease by disease. And in addition to getting country-specific information, there'll be outbreak and alerts posted for your country. So it's a good thing to look at before going to a specific country. The WHO also has a great website that travelers might want to look at, WHO.org. The U.S. State Department and specific country embassy websites would be worth looking at for extended stays. And then if you're looking for a travel clinic in your area in the United States and you want to know how to find it, the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene, or ASTMH.org, has a listing of all certified U.S. travel clinics. We're taping here in Washington, D.C., and there's Dr. Martin Wolf has the Traveler's Health Clinic, and this is a world-renowned clinic. It's actually one of the most well-known in the U.S. A couple other websites, www.iamat.org. This is the International Association for Medical Assistance for Travelers. Something else to consider bringing with you would be medevac insurance, and you may wish to check with your health insurance plan what is covered in the event that you need to get medical care abroad or evacuate from travel. And this is a good website for that. And then lastly, kidstraveldoc.com is a site that Cornell runs that answers general questions about traveling with children. This is just sort of a more parents-friendly pre-travel screening type of website.
Well, this has been a very enlightening, very helpful conversation for all of us. So, Dr. Eric Stern, thank you so much for being with us today to discuss travel with children in a time of high contagion.
Well, thank you, Sandy. Thank you, Linda. Thank you for having me.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 419, and please tell us if you can what station you're listening to.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Bird and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from Ruth and Mortimer Kaplan. Our sound engineer is Cadell Cook. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.